This is WGTDHD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, Vice President for Community and Government Relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Hello, this is Education Matters on WGTD. I'm your host, Jonathan Shaler, and today our guest is Aziz Hook. He's a law professor at the University of Chicago School of Law, a scholar of U.S. and comparative constitutional law. His recent work concerns democratic backsliding in the regulation of AI. His award-winning scholarship is published in several books and in leading law, social science, and political science journals. He also writes for Politico, The Washington Post, The New York Times, and many other non-specialist publications. In 2015, he received the Graduating Students Award for Teaching Excellence, and he has an active pro bono practice, is on the board of the American Constitution Society, the Seminary Co-op, the New Press, and the ACLU of Illinois. Before joining the law school faculty, Professor Hook was counsel and then director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Project, litigating cases at both the U.S. Courts of Appeals and the Supreme Court. As a senior consultant analyst for the International Crisis Group, he researched and wrote on constitutional design and implementation in Pakistan, Nepal, Afghanistan, and Sri Lanka. He was a law clerk for Judge Robert D. Sack of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit Court, and then for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's also a 1996 summa cum laude graduate of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and a 2001 graduate of Columbia Law School, where he graduated first in his class. Professor Hook was recently recognized as one of the top three legal scholars in the United States. He's the author of The Rule of Law, A Very Short Introduction, 2024, and also How to Save a Constitutional Democracy with his colleague Tom Ginsburg, 2022. Welcome, Professor Hook.
Hi, Jonathan. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. So you know why I invited you to the program. There have been recent events at Columbia University, most notably the withholding of $400 million in federal funds and resources from the university due to the federal administration's charges of anti-Semitism at that university. And this is supposed to act, I suppose, as a spur to get Columbia University to implement a list of certain procedures that the feds have come up with. You, a few days after that was announced, co-signed a statement from constitutional law scholars on Columbia. There were 18 signatories in total, and the gist of it was your statement that the government may not threaten funding cuts as a tool to pressure recipients into suppressing First Amendment protected speech. So perhaps you could tell us what galvanized this gesture and what you're thinking on it is at this moment.
I think that the motivating force for the statement you mentioned, which was drafted by a legal scholar called Michael Dorff at Cornell and another legal scholar called Eugene Volok at the Hoover Institute at Stanford, was the, in my judgment, accurate perception that the federal government, and in particular at the direction of the White House, was employing the lever created by federal financial support for universities as an instrument for altering and in particular suppressing speech that occurs on those university campuses, whether it is in the context of debate, raucous to the point of protest, or debate that occurs in scholarship and in classrooms by threatening the withdrawal of funds unless the university squelched certain viewpoints and certain perspectives. That kind of leveraging of financial support in order to manipulate a private entity's speech, which occurs outside the bounds of the federally funded program, is and has long been recognized as a violation of the First Amendment. And I would add to that the observation, which is one that's not underscored with as much force in the statement, but I think is also important, that the statute at stake in the Columbia interaction, which is an element of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, sets forth both a procedure and a constraint, a bound, upon the nature of the penalties that can be imposed for what are alleged violations of the non-discrimination provisions in federal civil rights law. And without regard to what you think of the underlying merits of the various charges lodged by the federal government, or the various accusations, I should say, because there are no charges, the various accusations lodged by the federal government against Columbia, and maybe we'll also talk about Penn, the statutory framework for bringing an allegation of a Civil Rights Act violation and for withdrawing funding on the basis of that violation was simply ignored. And so without regard or even apart from the constitutional question, what was done was plainly and explicitly in violation of federal statutory law. And in as much as this is a feature of many actions taken by the new administration, I think it raises really important legal questions and rule of law questions.
Thank you. So if our listeners wanted to learn more about the law that's involved here, are we talking about Title VI?
We're talking about Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which was adopted by Congress in 1964, which imposes a suite of non-discrimination mandates upon tertiary education institutions.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Penn. What's the Penn case?
My understanding is that the Trump administration has asserted that it will withhold $175 million in funding from the University of Pennsylvania. My understanding is that the ground of that withholding is that Penn has allowed I will confess that I do not know the details, and I want to be careful to acknowledge the limits of my knowledge. My understanding is that the charge or the allegation there is that Penn has permitted either a trans or a non-binary student to participate in a sports team. I believe it is a swimming team, although I cannot confirm that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so different issues, but similar principles at work here. And then there are the deportations, the detentions and the deportations. Do you see these actions by the federal government as related to free speech issues?
Absolutely. There have been a number of individuals who participated in protests last year with respect to events in the Middle East who have been either successfully detained or where there have been efforts to detain them on the basis of statutory authorities that are in the immigration law. Mm-hmm. And particularly in the first of those cases, which concerns a Columbia graduate of a master's program at Columbia, the threshold reasons given for the detention and for the proposed deportation were confined to the fact that the individual had engaged in speech off a viewpoint that the administration did not agree with. Mm-hmm. It is worth saying a couple of things. First, that both citizens and non-citizens benefit without caveat or difference from First Amendment rights when they are in the United States. It makes no difference whether you are a citizen or a non-citizen. When you are speaking or protesting within the bounds of the legal constraints on protest, in the United States, your activity, your speech is protected by the First Amendment. That's the first important thing to say. Mm-hmm. And the second important thing to say is that the statutory basis for the decision to remove this individual is one that has extremely rarely been invoked in the past, does not plainly on its face apply to lawful permanent residents. And the courts, including the Supreme Court, have said a number of times that where a deportation provision does not on its face apply to a lawful permanent resident, it is assumed to apply only to lawful individuals who are lawfully present but do not have a green card. So it's not clear that this statutory authority even applies to the person being detained. The evidence upon which the government has founded its detention is the last thing to say is that perhaps realizing that the evidence upon which it is seeking deportation in that case is so weak, the government has added an additional charge to the effect that the individual concerned made material omissions when they were applying for their green card. Mm. So it's a complicated case. There are a number of different statutory and constitutional legal questions implicated. But at the core of it is the question whether the government can use the immigration powers with respect to individuals plainly protected by the First Amendment on the basis of the viewpoint that they take. There is, I think, no real question that if the individuals who have been targeted through the use of these immigration powers had engaged in protests on the other side of the issue, that they would not be facing deportation now.
Hmm.
This is the quintessence of viewpoint discrimination that the First Amendment is supposed to prohibit.
Viewpoint discrimination. And in a recent article in The Atlantic titled "America is Watching the Rise of a Dual State," you draw connections to the example of Ernst Frankel, who wrote a book by that title, The Dual State, about the rise of authoritarianism in Nazi Germany. And in that article, the basic point being made here is that people can go from day to day living in a so-called normative state where everything seems to function as it should, economically, legally, civilly. However, there is a growing window or area of government that is prerogative, was the technical term. Could you explain what that means? And the reason I bring this into our discussion is that it seems to me that it's somehow related. And if I'm mistaken, you can correct me.
I'm sorry, Jonathan. I missed, there was a Zoom hitch, and okay. I missed the last sentence. I apologize.
Not any problem. So I guess what I was trying to get at was this growing prerogative state, meaning a state that is run by dictate, by an autocrat, is something that can happen kind of while people look away because they're not being directly affected. It's happening elsewhere kind of thing. You kind of intimate in that article that this is something that we should be alert to right now in the United States. And I guess I'm asking if you see the current actions by the federal government to control speech and viewpoints expression in on college campuses as part of this growing concern?
I think the way to understand the dual state idea is to think about the experience that Ernst Frankl had as a lawyer in 1930s Germany, where he experienced the emergence of a dual state. Frankl was a Jewish labor lawyer who had served in World War I, and as a consequence of that service was exempted from certain restrictions upon Jewish lawyers that the Nazi regime imposed in 1933. And as a consequence of the exemption, Frankl was able to remain in Berlin and practice as a lawyer until 1938, when he fled and actually came to the University of Chicago, where I teach, and wrote his book, The Dual State. And what Frankl meant by the phrase dual state was the following, that there were many cases in which he would represent people who were enemies of the political regime in power. They were trade unionists, they were dissenters of some sort. In some instances, their opposition took the form merely of being Jewish because of the ultimately genocidal anti-Semitism of the Nazis made them place those people into the category of the enemy. And under the ordinary laws of what had previously been Weimar Germany, most of which had not been displaced, Frankl's clients ought to have won. But what would happen is, in the midst of a trial, or in some instances after his clients had won, the Nazi regime would intercede and pull the person out from the ordinary legal system into a kind of gray zone where no law applied. And the key was that this extraordinary power to pull people outside the law coexisted with the ordinary legal system. So it was not the case, and never the case, that the ordinary rules of law, the ordinary functions of courts when it came to contracts, when it came to property disputes, when it came to corporate matters, ever dissipated in 1930s Germany. What happened was there emerged this parallel or alternate system of lawlessness that existed side by side with the ordinary law. And Frankl called that the prerogative state. And the title isn't necessarily the important thing. The idea is that you can have a zone of lawlessness, a zone in which the state and the people at the apex of the state have absolutely unfettered discretion to pursue their whims, and it can arise and emerge and operate alongside, almost under the floorboards of, the ordinary legal system. And Frankl would see this in cases where he would win, and I think this happened not in a case that he was the lawyer in, but in a case that he knew of and he always was thinking about. There was a case in which the defendant wins, the judge bangs the gavel, and mere moments later, a Gestapo agent turns up and places their hand on the shoulder of the defendant and says, "Kommt mich ich mir." I'm butchering the German, for which I apologize. "Come with me. We're off to Dachau." And that's I think, obviously there's not anything exactly analogous to that that's happening now. But this idea of a dual state, of two systems, of one legalistic, one a domain of unfettered whim and discretion, has been taken up by scholars and used to understand a number of other legal states where power is in some senses unlimited, but in other ways, ordinary commercial life goes on. So this turns out to be a pretty good description of Singapore. It turns out to be a pretty good description of many of the Gulf monarchies, which have sophisticated commercial systems and repressive apparatuses that exist alongside them. And I think you can look at the Colombia case, you can look at the deportations cases as the emergence of something like a dual state, because they are instances in which there is a clear rule of law. There is a statute that says you can do X but not Y, government, and where the government shrugs its shoulders and says, we don't care what the law says. And I would flag that I think that that indifference to the constraint imposed by standing law, by statutes duly enacted by the people's representatives in Congress, has become a hallmark of this administration in a way that I think is parallel to the structure of the dual state that Franco described.
Thank you for that. That's a really helpful summary, and I recommend the article to our listeners. So just to give a current example, Yun Seng, I don't know if you've heard of her situation, a legal permanent U.S. resident who was a Columbia student. She sued President Trump and over the bid to arrest, detain, and ultimately deport her. And a federal judge just this week ordered the Trump administration to halt those attempts. Now we'll see what happens in court, I guess. Do you see that as the functioning of our judicial system holding up under these pressures? And more generally, how do you think things are holding up?
I think that district court judges, who are the front line of the federal judicial system, have been placed under immense strain by A, a wave of litigation, and B, direct nakedly partisan attacks from both the White House and members of Congress. Attacks that I think are characteristic of regimes which have abandoned the rule of law very explicitly, and in general have tried to navigate this unprecedented situation with a measure of care and grace and tact that I think is necessary if they are to survive as legalistic institutions. Mm-hmm. I don't think all of them have been successful, but I think that the majority have been. I think the looming question is, I think there are two looming questions. The first is, in multiple cases, the Trump administration has ignored court orders. The Enemy Alien Act is litigation is the most obvious example, but there was another example of a oncologist who was employed by Brown, who was turned away at Logan Airport, notwithstanding the fact that Brown's lawyers had obtained an injunction that ought to have prevented her from being deported. That was an example, I think, where there was very clearly a conscious decision to ignore a court order. There's a question of, so the first question is well, are these orders going to be complied with? And we're seeing that this is not an administration, I think, that believes that it must comply with all court orders. Mm-hmm. Of course, it takes a very different view when it tries to use the law against its opponents. And second, what will happen when these cases reach the Supreme Court? And obviously the Supreme Court is a much, I think it's easy to think that just because something is a court, is called a court, it is something of a particular type. But I think that the Supreme Court is a fundamentally different body from the local courts or the trial courts that maybe people have experience with. It's essentially a policy-making body made out of nine people who are political appointees. Which is a very different matter from a lower court, a trial court, or a state court. And so I think it's much harder to know what the Supreme Court will do in comparison to the lower courts.
Mm-hmm. And maybe bringing this to a close, a final question that I have for you is, how are your students and your colleagues weathering all of this, since I think a chill is felt throughout academe at this time, at least that's been my experience. And what do you say to them to offer perspective and possibly even reassurance?
I don't think it's my job to offer reassurance. I think it is my job to try and help them candidly and clear-eyed, in a candid and clear-eyed way, see both the dynamics of the situation, where I do think we can say certain things with confidence about what the law is. We can say certain things about confidence about the ways in which the law is being violated. But we are at a moment where the aggregate of law violations are an effort to change the fundamental nature of the legal system. And I think the key uncertainty is, will that attempt succeed or not? Mm-hmm. And I think we don't know yet.
And we'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Professor Hook of the Law School of University of Chicago. Your time and your work in this area has been invaluable to us. So thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. I really appreciate you having me on the show.
And in our continuing coverage of the First Amendment and academic freedom controversies at Columbia University, I am pleased to introduce my guest from Columbia University. This is Professor Michael Thaddeus of the Mathematics Department. Professor Thaddeus is a graduate of Harvard University, a Rhodes Scholar, who received his PhD from Oxford University. He's been teaching at Columbia University for 27 years and has been chair of the math department, very active on campus, and is perhaps best known nationally as the whistleblower who looked at the U.S. News and World Report Best College Rankings in 2021, I believe it was, 22, and found that the data that Columbia University had submitted did not properly represent the university's standings. And as a result, there was quite an outcry, and Columbia was taken off the rankings for a year before returning at a lower place. I think went from 2 down to 18. But this is all history, and just giving you a sense that Professor Thaddeus is not afraid to be critical of his own university and still deeply loves it, as far as I understand. I hope I don't overstate my case. Welcome, Professor Thaddeus.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me on the show.
Great. So you were the leader, or among the leaders, of the faculty who recently protested the Trump administration's $400 million, what should we call it, withholding of funds from Columbia University, and more pointedly, the chancellor's letter agreeing to all of the conditions that the administration had laid down for an ability to even negotiate with the administration regarding the resumption of the funding. Is that correct?
Yeah, thank you for stipulating that. I mean, what a lot of people are saying is the federal government canceled $400 million in grants, research grants to Columbia, and these demands that they made Friday before last were a condition for the restoration of the funding. But as you correctly noted, they weren't a condition for the restoration of the funding. They were just a precondition for discussions to open about the restoration of the funding. And so, as you also correctly stated, last Friday, in the late afternoon, my university put out an unsigned, anonymous 4-page memo basically acquiescing to every one of the demands. There's maybe a little bit of daylight in each case between what the Trump administration demanded and what Columbia agreed to do, but point by point, I mean, they basically have acquiesced to every single one. In spite of that, there's been no statement by the Trump administration that the grants will be restored. The education secretary was asked about it on Sunday, and she just said something like, well, a Columbia statement is a positive sign and we're making progress. So it seems like a classic case of extortion where when something is being extorted from you and you hand over exactly what the bully is asking for, then it turns out that you're not going to get back whatever has been withheld from you.
I think Emeritus Professor Frankie has been also very outspoken.
She's always very outspoken, yes.
Yes, and has also used that term extortion to refer to the letter. So where do we go from here? What was the point of the protest?
The point of the protest really was just consciousness raising. a lot of this drama happened over spring break. This anonymous memo was put out on Friday afternoon during spring break. Students were away, a lot of faculty were out of town. And so the purpose of the demonstration was just for us as faculty to seize control of the narrative. We really feel that our administration has let us down grievously. And there's a lot of dismay about that, a lot of alarm. But there's also a sense that it's, you know, that we need to take the lead. And if faculty somehow manage to lead the way, then our leaders will follow. So, yes. so the content of the demonstration rather was the signs, the slogans, the speeches, and so on were quite general about the threats to the university and to higher education in general from the new administration in Washington. And we're going to get more specific in the weeks and months to come.
I see. And of course, your outcry has been echoed and is being broadly expressed through a number of outlets. I already mentioned Emeritus Professor Franke. There's an open letter from former, from Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, graduates, journalists in the Guardian today, yesterday, March 25th, we call on Columbia to stand up to authoritarianism. The History Department at Columbia has also published a letter to President Armstrong objecting to this desire to of the Trump administration to assert political control over the university. And somewhere I read that you know, now is the time to stand up, and really what is needed is a broad statement from a large collection of colleges and universities across the United States before they get picked off one by one. What do you think about that statement?
That sounds like a great idea. And when you talk about a statement from colleges and universities, it could come from the administrations of those institutions, or it could come from faculty organizations, faculty senates, faculty governance groups, or a third possibility, it could come from a national organization of university faculty. Well, an organization like that exists, and it's called the American Association of University Professors. That's the organization that that sponsored the demonstration on Monday. I was an organizer, but it was really put on by the Barnard and Columbia chapters of the AAUP. And you're going to hear a lot more from the AAUP in the coming weeks.
I see. Okay. So that is something. Thank you for that. So I'm not sure where we go from here in terms of explaining to the public, because I think this is important. This is public radio. Exactly what the stipulations are that the university is being asked to adhere to. One of them is a kind of broad one. Is to make the campus safe by applying a definition of anti-Semitism crafted by the Trump administration, which in essence says any speech that expresses hatred toward the Jewish people, or I believe toward Zionism. I believe that's included as well. And I'm wondering, I didn't bring you on here as a free speech expert, but it seems to me that in demonstrations, student demonstrations, all kinds of demonstrations, a very wide range of feelings and views can be expressed. Not everybody is on the same page. Some people are more virulent than others. If somebody says down with Zionism, for example, is that anti-Semitism?
That's a very good question and a very thorny question that, you just raised. And one thing that we have to remember is that the people demonstrating are students. They're young. They can be impetuous and hot-headed. And students have said all kind of impetuous, ill-considered things on university campuses for years. But something that has really changed is now we have social media, Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If a student says an impetuous, ill-considered, or even an angry and hateful thing, it can be beamed around the world in a matter of minutes. And so people are on much more of a hair trigger than they used to be. We had a disruption of a class at Columbia on the first day of classes this year, which also happened to be inauguration day, January 21st. Mm. And this disruption involved four students who were in masks. They came in and they spent 4 minutes in the class. It was peaceful, but they handed out flyers with really shocking and offensive images. There's no denying that. Nevertheless, I really think that in any time in the past, that a class disruption of one class by four students that lasted 4 minutes and ended with those students leaving voluntarily, that would not have been instantly covered, in the news and opinion sections of the New York Times the way it is now. Well, so everyone's just on a hair trigger in a way that they were not before. That's the first point to make. The second point, as you say, is that there's a lot of disagreement about what constitutes or what properly should constitute a definition of anti-Semitism. And there's controversy about what is the correct definition to use. And when somebody says down with Zionism, some people are just using that as code. There's no denying that when some people use the word Zionism, they're what they purport to be anti-Zionism is just a cover for their anti-Semitism. There's one just notoriously virulently anti-Semitic demonstrator who has stood around outside the front gate of Columbia for 10 years now, perhaps. Clearly, he's not a university affiliate. He has nothing to do with the university. He's taken to wearing a mask. And he used to carry just boldly anti-Semitic slogans on his sign. It was kind of shocking to pass by. But since the Gaza war broke out, now he's switched to anti-Zionist slogans. So that guy is not fooling anyone. Oh. That guy is anti-Semitic, and he really is using anti-Zionism as a cover. Yeah. On the other hand, Zionism is a political movement, and there are some people who are genuinely anti-Zionist without being anti-Semitic. There are even a lot of Jews on our campus who would describe themselves as anti-Zionist. So I think ultimately, if you conflate anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, you're conflating religion with politics. And there has to be a bright line. There has to be which says that criticizing someone else's religion is not acceptable, that religious faith and religious observance is something that everyone should be is entitled to everyone's respect. But politics is fair game, and it's perfectly all right to criticize people for their politics. So handing out as another hypothetical, handing out a flyer that says down with the Democratic Party or down with the Republican Party, that's clearly fair game. No one would say that kind of speech is hate speech or that it deserves sanction. No, politics is all about promoting certain views and trying to defeat other views. So there has to be an understanding that Zionism is fundamentally a political movement, and therefore there has to be a clear distinction between pro-Semitism and pro-Zionism, anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism.
And with the broader the definition is, the more indistinct it is, the more the agencies that are authorized to enforce these definitions can act at will.
That's right. And part of part of what's been so bad about the last year and a half is that no one is really sure what the right definitions are. No one is our own rules and the bodies enforcing those rules constantly changing. And that has what's called a chilling effect. It means that people are just afraid to speak out about these subjects at all.
So where things stand now, what would you like our audience to be thinking about as events move forward, both at Columbia and nationally, because we've got the University of Pennsylvania implicated in another case, and we have students being detained. We have students attempting to be deported. Where should we be focusing our thoughts and energies at this time?
That's such a bewildering question, right? I mean, the whole strategy of the new administration in Washington has been to flood the zone, to create so many crises at the same time, overlapping crises, that it's hard to know what to concentrate on first and what to do. You know, on March 8th, a former Columbia student, Mahmoud Khalil, who was still living in Columbia housing and who was a permanent resident of the United States, a holder of a green card, married to a U.S. citizen, his wife is 8 months pregnant, he was arrested in the lobby of their Columbia building by federal immigration police who just pushed their way into the building. They didn't have a warrant to be there. And, you know, since then he's been spirited off to Louisiana where he's being held without charge. So that was a, you know, shattering event for many of us on the campus, especially people who do not hold U.S. passports themselves, permanent residents of the United States or those who are here on temporary visas. And that includes thousands, in fact, tens of thousands of people at Columbia alone. So from the point of view of those people, that assault by the Trump administration on their rights to free expression and public assembly, because that's what it was. That's, you know, since Mr. Khalil hasn't been charged with any crime, it's fairly clear, even from the official statements of the administration in Washington, it's fairly clear that what they object to was just that he participated in demonstrations.
And I've been speaking to Professor Michael Thaddeus of the math department at Columbia University about recent actions taken by the Trump administration and Columbia's response. Professor Thaddeus, we were going to talk about the impact of that $400 million of grants and funding. What is the impact?
It's astonishing because these are grants, federal research grants. You know, lots of young researchers, postdoctoral researchers, graduate students, as well as some senior people, mostly working up at our medical center. I mean, these grants were mostly for research on medicine and public health. So there are researchers working on cancer. There are researchers working on various aspects of mental health. There are researchers working on women's health. Suddenly, all of their grants have been rescinded or suspended, and there are people who literally from one day to the next have been left with no source of any livelihood. And they're doing, you know, vitally important work. And also, Jonathan, this the other important point is that most of these people had absolutely nothing to do with the demonstrations last year that this action was supposedly in response to. They work uptown at our medical campus, which is a completely separate campus from the Morningside campus where the protests occurred. Very few of them took part in the protests or anything like that. So, and the legal basis of the grant cancellation is just non-existent, that there are legal procedures for addressing, acts of prejudice at universities as the Civil Rights Act, but those procedures were not followed. So this really, it just isn't an enforcement action. It's just a political vendetta.
I see. Well, Dr. Thaddeus, it has been invaluable to have you on the program and to get some insight from on the ground, so to speak, at the university. I wish you well and your colleagues well, and I hope that things move in a better direction at the soonest possible opportunity.
Thank you. Yes, we hope so too. And it's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Anyway, what you've been listening to is WGTD-FM's Education Matters with your host, Jonathan Shaler.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Boys and Girls Club of Kenosha is holding its annual Dairy State Cheese and Beer Festival fundraiser Saturday, April 12th at the Parkway Chateau from 1 to 5. Tickets are available on the Boys and Girls Club website.
I'm Gregory Berg, and my guest for Monday's morning show, Scott Coey, is going to be wearing two different hats. First, as an outstanding teacher at Bradford High School, where he has taken a number of students on fascinating trips to foreign countries. But we'll also speak to him as a member of the Racine Unified School Board, and we will talk about the referendum that is going to be confronting Racine voters on Tuesday, the 1st of April. Join us for Monday's morning show beginning just after 8. Support comes from the Kenosha Community Foundation, a public charity that encourages community members to build a legacy for themselves and their families through tax-advantaged giving. To learn how, visit kenoshafoundation.org or call 262-654-2412. Support comes from the Lake Geneva Symphony in concert on Saturday, April 5th at 7 p.m. at Badger High School with Mendelssohn's Fifth Symphony.